This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in June of 2017.
We jump down to a very interesting history. The new book is The Best Land Under Heaven, The Donner Party in the Age of Manifest Destiny, historian Michael Wallace. The author of the book writes, "Were it not for a few wrong turns, bad directions, and fierce winter storms, the Donner Party would have been an unremarkable wagon train. As it happens, it became a cautionary tale of manifest destiny and unforgettable calamity. Personal motives of the immigrants varied. The bulk of the Donner Party, however, was composed of people who left the country of their fathers to dwell on the land they sincerely believed their children were destined to inherit. They were vivid examples of those who live in the future and make their country as they go along. They found that in pursuing what came to be known as the American Dream, nightmares are sometimes the consequence." Very interesting new book. Michael Wallace is the best-selling author of Route 66 and Billy the Kid. He's published 18 books, won numerous honors and awards, and he's a popular public speaker and an acclaimed voice actor. He lives in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and joins us for the hour. Michael Wallace, welcome to the program.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Before we jump into this fascinating history, I want to talk about some of your other work just briefly. You have a part, ongoing part, in I think all of the versions of Cars.
Well, I do in the Cars franchise, as we call it, the animated films produced by the creative genius John Lasseter and Pixar, now Pixar Disney Studios. And I was with them from the get-go. I, because of my Route 66, the Mother Road book, the book that came out in 1990 and really sparked the renaissance along the highway, the revival of interest, I became their consultant in developing the movie. I wrote a book with my wife called The Art of Cars about the making of the movie, and subsequently became the voice of the sheriff of Radiator Springs, that 1949 Mercury, and have appeared in all three movies. Of course, Cars 3 has just premiered across the country. And then also helped the Disney Imagineers create Cars Land, a 12-acre attraction in California Adventure next to Disneyland that's really the village of Radiator Springs come to life. And all of us, all the car characters, are there to greet you and meet you, and it's become probably the most popular single attraction in Anaheim. So it goes way back, and it's all started because of my love and desire to preserve Route 66.
Interesting connection. Yeah, that's kind of disparate careers there, right? Voice acting and history, but you've made a connection there for us, so appreciate that.
It's good cross-pollination.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I want to jump into this very fascinating book on the Donner Party. What brought you to this? You've spent a lot of time on this, retraced the path of the ill-fated wagon train. What made you want to tackle this subject?
It was a subject actually tailor-made for me, because what I have done with the majority of my books, especially my biographies of Billy the Kid, David Crockett, the Dust Bowl Bandit, Pretty Boy Floyd, others, Oil Barons, Indian Chiefs, is I like to focus on figures in history, characters, episodes, events that are so wound up in myth and legend, and unravel them and expose the true story, which is inevitably the better story, the more authentic story. And that was certainly the case here with the Donner Party.
I want to read just a little section here from your introduction, where you do make this larger connection. It's in the subtitle of the book, The Donner Party in the Age of Manifest Destiny. But you write, "Their story has come to symbolize the great American dream gone awry. The Donner Party's fate highlighted the ambitiousness, folly, recklessness, and ruthlessness that marked the great expansionist westward movement. The party becomes a microcosm of the United States, which, while busily consuming other nations, Mexico and Indian tribes that stood in the way of westward migration, had the potential to consume itself. This gothic tale of cannibalism draws a real parallel between individuals consuming flesh and the desire of a country to consume the continent. So I wonder, here at the beginning, get into some individual stories here. Talk to me a little bit about this idea of manifest destiny. This really was an ideal that I guess most of the country had, certainly those with the frontier mindset.
Well, certainly the eastern United States, where the majority of people lived, it was a notion that evolved into a crystallized into an idea and then a cause and a movement called Manifest Destiny. It really was launched full steam ahead in 1845, the year before the Donners left Springfield, Illinois, and this whole movement, Manifest Destiny, was built around the idea that God Almighty himself had deemed the Anglo population of the eastern United States, given them the right, the manifest right in their destiny to consume, to conquer and control and possess the balance of the continent all the way to the Pacific. And that was the driving force. And in many cases, the rationale was that this was largely an unpopulated area. And in truth, that there were great vast areas that were unpopulated, but there were people there, although they weren't deemed as people. They were, most of that country belonged either to Mexico or was populated by scores of Indian tribes. But again, we had rationalization. Those people weren't really considered humans, and they really didn't count, so it was our land for the taking. And then James Polk conveniently sparked a war with Mexico that was basically a land grab, and was able to take a good many of what's now the Southwest and beyond in that war. The editorial we, those foot soldiers of Manifest Destiny, such as the Donner Reed Party, moved westward, and the rest, as the old cliche goes, is history.
Yeah, I think we sometimes forget that the Donner Party, others, were heading out of the United States. If you're heading to California, you're heading to Alta California, a province of Mexico. But the ideal was, we're going to spread the ideals, right? We spread the liberty, we spread this form of government, we're going to spread civilization.
Well, that was the lofty goal. In fact, as you can imagine, there were a multitude of reasons why people left. And most of them weren't that altruistic. They wanted to get more land. They wanted to gain more wealth. They wanted to start their lives over again. A lot of the younger single men went just for pure adventure. There were many, many reasons why people went to the West. Of course, a couple years after the Donner Party, the main reason was gold, because just in that region where the Donners were trying to end up is where gold was discovered, and that brought on the big crush, the big rush into the former Mexican province of Alta California.
Just parenthetically, it was interesting while I was reading this book to compare and contrast this to the Mormon migration, which happened a year later.
Yes.
With the Mormons, they were somewhat relieved to be leaving the United States, fleeing persecution.
They were indeed, and that was their motive, and obviously it was a good motive. It was a good reason to leave, and of course that whole incredible Mormon movement, as you explained, going on just a tad later than the Donner Party, ended up with triumph, if you will, for the greater Mormon nation. but it was not quite the same for people like the Donners. And what one needs to understand that in telling the story of the Donner Party, the obvious always comes up and comes up very quickly, and that, of course, is the fact that they had to ultimately rely on survival cannibalism. But the fact is that did occur. If it wasn't for that obvious, the Donners simply would have been another wagon caravan crossing over the High Sierras and been, as we say, just a little footnote in history.
So set the scene for me to tell me about this cross section. Was this a fairly typical cross section? Some 87 people in this company. It was various motives, as you've said.
Yeah, it was, and about that number 87. Yeah, that's ultimately what we ended up with. But what people need to know, and what they find in reading the book, is that first of all, it didn't become known as the Donner Party till very late in the journey, when through attrition and other things, George Donner, one of the two Donner brothers, was picked to be the captain of the caravan. But long before that, when they struck out from Springfield, Illinois in April 1846, the two Donner families and the James Reed family, they went immediately to Independence, Missouri, the gathering point for all the caravans. And there they left the United States, going into what's now Kansas, and very soon joined a larger caravan. And this was very typical. And that caravan was captained by a very colorful character named Owl Russell. But the caravans changed. All the caravans changed en route, especially these large ones. There were disagreements. Some families were told to leave because they had too much cattle and it was slowing down the pace. People were not like-minded always. Well, let's do this, let's do that. And some people just gave up and left, and others joined other caravans. And in the case of the original caravan that was the Donners, a great number of the single men, tired of the pace of the wagons, got rid of their wagons mid-journey and turned to mules and went on muleback all the way out and slipped into the so-called land of milk and honey of California long before the winter snows, and where they're safely ensconced in California when the Donner Party was marooned on the other side of the Sierras. But and they were from all walks of life. They were wheelwrights, they were professional people, some were attorneys, they were entrepreneurs, they were wealthy farmers. In order to go on a caravan like that, with the type of wagons, the oxen teams they had, to hire the teamsters to bring that cattle, they had to have a little bit of money to begin with. So these were not destitute people at all. In fact, several of the families carried with them great sums of cash money, which they planned to put to good use in California, buying up land.
And this is the draw is always, well, for most of these is land, right? Best land,
sure,
under heaven, right? The riches that await in California. And this is part of the history of many of these people. You write the backstory. I recall, George Donner Jr. comes from a family. His father, George Sr., had moved many times in his life.
They had. All those Donners had. Like so much of that westward movement, the frontier used to be, of course, on the eastern seaboard, and it kept moving west. So they came out of that early Carolina tradition and just kept inching their way west into Indiana and Kentucky and finally into Illinois. They even, George Donner and some of his kin even spent a year going down into Texas after it became a republic to see what that was all about. And it certainly wasn't acceptable to them, so they quickly came back to Illinois. And I must say, most people do think that the title The Best Land Under Heaven refers to California. But in fact, the best land under heaven was where they were, and that was a reference to Illinois. It was called that in an early 19th century poem, this land, the best land under heaven. So ultimately, at least in the case of George and Jacob Donner, who died marooned in those camps, the Donner family probably should have stayed where they were doing quite well. And in fact, many of them did. There are Donners still forming that rich soil of Sangamon County, Illinois, to this very day.
So that's that can be seen as a microcosm of the nation as well, right? At least some people should have stayed put, but it's that restless spirit.
Yes, and believe me, in writing this book, I'm not attacking or criticizing people who moved west. I'm looking at the broader canvas behind this story, and that's this assumption that really literally the arrogance of manifest destiny. You know, and there are so many ironies. At the same time that this is going on, thousands of famine Irish are pouring into this country, starving to death. You know, and then you have this whole metaphor, of course, of us consuming the continent to take it all. So there are so many interesting parallels in the Donner story, and almost every other book, and there's some very good ones and some not so good about the Donner Party, but typically everyone sort of focuses on what I call the obvious, which again is very important because that's why we know the story of survival cannibalism. But in many cases, that's greatly exaggerated and a lot of hyperbole and sometimes even outright lies.
And we'll get to that, of course, as we go along with the story.
Sure.
And I was struck, you have a list of the entire Donner Party and, you know, survived, killed, died.
Right.
And then you have comments, you know, cannibalized.
Yes.
Several were, and it is fascinating. It's morbidly fascinating, and that's, as you say, that's why we focus on the Donner Party. There are the facets here as well. Before we go to break, I want to bring up the starting point. That was Springfield, Illinois. That's the Donners farmed near Springfield. At the time, a young Whig congressman named Abraham Lincoln was having some doubts, right, about this whole mindset. He thought the nation's character was changing for the worse.
He did indeed. There are so many dichotomies in that whole story. You know, here you have Lincoln, who did, in fact, while they were gone, was elected just as they started to Congress and served while Polk was president. And he did stand out against that war in Mexico and reacted exactly the way you described. However, at the same time, as you learn in this book, Lincoln was also fascinated with California and was a very close friend of many of the members of the party, especially James Reed, one of the principals of the party. And James Reed and his wife Margaret and their family are an interesting sub-story just in themselves. But those two men had served together as messmates in the very brief Black Hawk War many years before. They knew each other. Lincoln became Reed's lawyer in helping him with his various business enterprises in Springfield, Illinois. And after Reed was totally crushed by the Great Depression of 1837, Lincoln continued to work with him for many years as he attempted to rebuild his life, James Reed. And ultimately, just before they struck out, the Donner-Reed Party, Lincoln helped him through bankruptcy, and even, we now know, helped him stash some money away, a great deal of money that later helped Reed very much when he's buying real estate in California. But we now know also that Lincoln actually thought about going with the Donner Party, and Reed wanted him to go and invited him to go. But Lincoln had other ambitions, and certainly so did his wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, who was a pretty strong soul herself, and she had one little toddler son and was pregnant with another, and her thoughts were not going to California. So even after the Donner Party, Lincoln was offered a government post in the Northwest and had to turn it down. But to his dying day in 1865, he dreamed of California, and that's why he became such a big proponent of the Transcontinental Railroad. But unfortunately, Abe never made it to California, and perhaps that's a good thing, or our 16th president could have ended up an entree in the High Sierras.
Yeah, that's just amazing to think about the vagaries of fate. I guess that is amazing.
Yeah, it is.
Let's take a break, then we'll continue the story of the Donner Reed Party. The book is The Best Land Under Heaven, The Donner Party in the Age of Manifest Destiny. The author is Michael Wallace. We'll return following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest for the hour is historian Michael Wallace. He is the best-selling author of Route 66 and Billy the Kid. He's published 18 books, won numerous honors and awards. He's a popular public speaker and acclaimed voice actor. He is appearing in Cars 3. He's the sheriff. He's appeared in the other movies as well. Lives in Tulsa, Oklahoma. His latest book, fascinating book, The Best Land Under Heaven, The Donner Party in the Age of Manifest Destiny. If you'd like to join the program with your question or comment, you can certainly do that. You can email us to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. So, Michael Wallace, you write again, I'll repeat this, the Donner Party's fate highlighted the ambitiousness, folly, recklessness, ruthlessness that marked the great expansionist westward movement. But for a few wrong turns, bad directions, and fierce winter storms, Donner Party would have been an unremarkable wagon train. Of course, we know that there were wrong turns, bad directions, fierce winter storms. I wonder if we could outline a few of the, I guess, the wrong decisions that were made.
Yes, they were, first and foremost, like everyone else who walks this earth, the Donners were, in fact, human. And prone to have their own minds in many ways, and it was often difficult for them to come to agreement. And this was typical, by the way, with all of the wagon trains. But in this case, we know for sure that some of the main reasons they ended up in the predicament they did is, number one, following bad advice. And they started, long before they left Springfield, they started doing all they could to research this trip. They knew people who had already made the trip successfully, and so they had their correspondence and notes. They were reading some of the journals of Fremont, the great pathfinder, but they were particularly paying attention to a guidebook, a guide to California and Oregon that was put up for these immigrants by Lansford Hastings, who was a very attorney and a very early California land promoter. And unfortunately, it was a book that contained many inaccuracies. And in that guidebook, Hastings extolled the virtues of a shortcut that he claimed would save them much time. And this was a shortcut in the present state of Utah. And they were led to believe that they could circumvent much of the arid, totally arid desert lands and take this shortcut, which came to be known as the Hastings Cutoff, and then rejoin the California Trail much later to the west. And James Reed, who is, again, one of the most powerful characters in this whole story, really pushed it. And but even on their way out, when they met different people, James Clyman, a savvy old mountain man who had also served with Lincoln and Reed in the Black Hawk War and was from Illinois, but had spent many years of his life, even as a youth, trapping throughout the whole Rocky Mountain system, and he knew the land better than anyone, he urged them, don't follow this guy's advice. He's a charlatan. He hasn't even taken the trail himself. It's unproven. But they still went on. Then later, they were lied to by the very colorful Jim Bridger at his training post. Jim Bridger, wanting business from these immigrants, had his training post at the start of that cutoff. So he told them, proceed. And not only that, but letters had been left behind for the Donners from others before them saying, don't take this trail. And for some peculiar reason, Bridger forgot to give them those letters. Forgot in quotes. So they soon found, when they took this purported shortcut, that it indeed was disastrous. They literally had to hack their way through brush, and it lost them an incredible amount of time. And they were further held up later when, in crossing that great salt desert in Utah. And what happened is, occasionally when they did break through the desert sands or the thick brush, then they would reward themselves, and instead of resting for a day or two, sometimes they said, well, let's rest another day, and so forth. And that happened actually right before they reached the point where they were trapped, when they went into this great lush meadow on the borderlands of what's now Nevada and California, and stayed too long there. And so it was only a matter of, it was just a matter of days that kept them from crossing over the Sierras. But by the time they finally got to that point, a series of winter storms, 10, maybe a dozen unbelievable winter storms that rage from early in the season in October through April, hit the Sierras, and snows accumulated 20, 30 feet high, even higher. And they were doomed. They were doomed from the start. And it's only a miracle that so many of them, more than half of the party, was able to survive.
There's a very poignant photograph, and then you write in a passage book near the end of your book. 1918, 70 years later, they erect a monument, right? And it's 22 feet high, because that's how high the snow was.
At that point, it was 22 feet high at that monument. And actually, that's described in the prologue to my book, which is a day that I painstakingly recreated based on a reportage and diaries and journals. It's really one of my favorite sections, albeit brief, of the whole story. It's a prologue, but it's also a fitting benediction.
Yeah, that's right. It is the prologue. I had that wrong. And there's the governor of California, governor of Nevada, and then three ladies, three elderly ladies who had been children at this horrific event.
70 years before, those three women were little girls, one from the Reed party and two Donner sisters. And they represented that occasion, this glorious occasion with speeches and trout banquets and cruises on what became known as Truckee Lake, was now called Donner Lake, on a beautiful day. They represented the eight other surviving members of the greater Donner Party. And as I describe what they were going through at that time. I particularly talk about Frances Donner, who, as the speeches ended and the big monument was unwrapped and went on, how she slipped her hand down into the pocket of her coat to feel the bits of peppermint and cookies she had always kept with her. She always had bits of food with her ever since that day, 70 years past, when she was rescued. And it was said when her hand found that hard candy and she pressed them, a smile budded on her face. And I think that's just a lovely, terrific, sad scene.
So the Donner Party, they've delayed. They have, and now they find themselves trapped. Series of winter storms. They're snowed in. I guess at some point it becomes clear to them that we're not going to be able to get out of this, at least easily. Some 80 odd people, and then as you write in the book, then you've as it gets worse and worse. You eat the larger animals. You eat the pets, right? You eat mice.
Yes.
You've got to make decisions. Do we share food or not? And do we leave family behind or not?
Yes. And that's when it is, to make an understatement, that's when it is quite serious, if you will, deadly serious. That's when you see all sorts of reactions. You see some people behaving with courage and benevolence, and others just the opposite. It was a terrible 1-2 punch of what we now call, didn't call it then, hypothermia, literally freezing to death, and starvation. And as you said, they literally ate anything they could find that they thought would produce some protein. They obviously ate all the stock, the horses, the oxen. They even boiled their hides and made this really disgusting sort of gelatinous gruel that they continued to drink until the hides had nothing left to give. They picked all the marrow out of the animal bones. They, yes, indeed, did capture field mice in their little survival cabins and eat them. And then, sadly, they did kill their beloved dogs. They were like family members and eat them. It got to the point where they were chewing on pine cones and ponderosa pine bark, which gave them absolutely no nutrition. But in these stages of starvation, they just needed to chew. And they were becoming delirious. And then they started dying. Mm. And the bodies were placed in the snowbanks, tucked away. And then one large party struck out. They always kept looking for help, because some people had left the party for one reason or another, and they thought they were bringing help, and in some cases they did bring help. One man got it back with two Miwok Indians with some supplies that lasted for a while. But this party that came to be known in history as the Forlorn Hope had a terrible, ultimately successful trek. They finally made it, but it was so severe. This is when we experienced the first survival cannibalism, was with that group, and it was so difficult. There was nothing cavalier about this. It was totally the last resort. And you know, so many people, when they say to me, "Oh, the Donner Party," and they sort of turn up their, "Oh my God, cannibals." And I immediately look at them and say, "Let me ask you something, my friend. What would you do? What would you do if you were a mother or a father and you see before you your children literally starving and freezing to death? You yourself are starving to death. And you know that in the snow are those stores of protein in human flesh. And I always tell them what I would do. In an instant, I would brandish my knife and save my family.
It is, I think, that part of the morbid fascination here is cannibalism is there's a big taboo.
They
crossed the line.
It ranks up there with bestiality and incest. Yeah. But this is survival cannibalism. It's certainly not ritualistic cannibalism. And what people don't understand is we've always had cannibalism in human existence. It goes back to the beginning. And it's survival cannibalism, and it's because of wars, natural disasters, and so forth. Even at that time in the 19th century, there were many incidents of maritime cannibalism with shipwrecks and so forth were the same thing. They just got down to where they had to, polar expeditions and so forth. Even in the 20th century, in the Warsaw Ghetto, it besieged Stalingrad. Ultimately, people had to turn to human flesh to survive.
You write that, at least in the first instances, you know, this was very hard on the people. They avoided eye contact, wept.
Yes,
what they were doing.
It was so difficult. And what they tried to do, which sounds obvious, is not to eat the flesh of a relative. In the way they prepared this sustenance was to cut small slices of flesh and then often just roast it on a fire or dry it, and it was much like pieces of jerky. They didn't, you know, people, the newspaper accounts of the day and a lot of the dime novelists and a lot of the accounts that came out, you know, portray them as sitting around, you know, holding a big haunch of meat and, you know, these wild-eyed cannibals. And that's the way the story was told, but it did not happen that way.
Were there any instances of people being killed in order to be eaten, murdered, in other words?
Well, unfortunately, there were. Mm-hmm. All along the trail, there were deaths before. One elderly woman died right away. A sick man died on the trail. Two immigrants murdered another one. Ultimately learned to steal his treasure. There was a knife a killing and a fracas with a member of the party and a teamster. There was an accidental shooting death with two brother-in-laws right before they were marooned. But many people have always said, but there was no one killed to be cannibalized, and that's simply not true. Those two Miwok Indians I mentioned, Luis and Salvador, were vaqueros for John Sutter, who later became very famous for Sutter's Mill and the site of the discovery of gold. He was a early land baron in California, and virtually had a slave force of various Indian tribes from California, including many Miwok Indians, and that worked for him. He was a very disagreeable individual and a con man in his own right. However, he did send out these two Miwoks with a member of the Donner Party that made it in, and they brought out mule loads of food that lasted for a while. They were with the Forlorn Hope, the party then trying to make it back, and the two Miwoks refused to eat the human flesh. And they became very weak ultimately, and finally it was decided that, well, they're Indians, so they're not really humans, so they were shot, both of them, field dressed and eaten. And it just it was a startling event. But of course, there were no repercussions at all. And then the Forlorn Hope continued on its way.
And you draw parallels here between the larger Manifest Destiny, larger migration. And there's an irony that you point out. Donner Party had set out in part to civilize a barbaric land, and then they end up, quote-unquote, savages.
They did. They did indeed. And that actually backfired on them with the proponents of Manifest Destiny, because if you were a Manifest Destiny soldier and a true believer in that, you needed to conquer nature. You needed to conquer the timber. You needed to plumb the earth for its riches. You needed to conquer anybody that got in your way, i.e. Indians, Mexicans, and so forth. And so the Manifest Destiny folks looked upon the Donner Party as total failures because they weren't able to fully conquer the land.
They weren't manly enough, I guess, or they weren't conquering nature. Interesting.
Yeah.
Let's take another break. When we come back, I want to talk about the aftermath and the rest of the story. It's fascinating. Some, like James Reed, became very successful. Others became recluses. And I want to talk about the aftermath as we go along and the parallels here between the Donner Party and the larger nation. More following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. We are talking with Michael Wallace. He is a best-selling author. His latest book's fascinating books called The Best Land Under Heaven, The Donner Party in the Age of Manifest Destiny. So we talked about the Donner Party, a cross-section of America. They've headed out for their dreams in California and have been caught in these snowstorms up Truckee Lake, now called Donner Lake, I believe. The reason we know about them is, or they've become so famous, is they had to resort to survival cannibalism. So Michael Wallace, there are four heroic rescue parties, and finally about half of the company gets out alive, I guess, approximately.
Yeah, that's true. These immigrants were trapped on the east side of the Sierras from late October, and the last survivor, a lone survivor, who I'll get to in a moment, was rescued in April. Two of those months, they were finally able to rally and put together four separate relief parties. The readers will find that a person very instrumental to that whole rescue operation was, in fact, James Reed. And his story is an amazing story in and of itself. But for 2 months, over the course of 2 months, those relief parties went out. Some of the relief party members ended up dying on route or coming back. But in the end, when the last survivor was brought out, a man named Louis Kesberg, and the tally was made, 41 people had died, 46 survived, and several of them perished, of course, before reaching the Sierras, and at least 35 died either at these camps or attempting to cross the mountains, and one died even after reaching the safety of the valley at the foot of the western slope. Many of those who did survive lost toes to frostbite, and as you might expect, they suffered chronic physical and psychological disorders. Some of them vowed to never speak of it again and kept everything bottled up within them. They led miserable lives, while many more went on to, especially, of course, the children, who remained, for the most part, unscarred, like the older ladies we talked about in the prologue, grew into maturity and had families and led successful lives. And James Reed and his family, or the entire family, survived without any loss. And the Reeds were the only family that not once had to partake of human flesh. And James Reed went on to become one of the principal civic and business leaders of what became San Jose, California. In fact, there are streets in San Jose today that are named for his children. So it was various experiences for the survivors.
You're right, and I think this is a key quote in this story. There's no shades of black and white, only gray. I'm thinking about that with James Reed. He became very prominent afterward. The Reed family apparently got through without cannibalism, yet he had killed a man out there on the trail.
He had killed a man, and it's not my job to judge or any of these people. I just tell it like it was. But in a way, Reed could actually be just. It probably today would have been called a justifiable homicide, because this was a teamster who had become quite angry and was using the handle end of his whip to hit these poor oxen that were becoming problematic to him. And he struck and wounded one of Reed's teamsters, and then struck Reed's wife, Margaret, and then struck Reed, and that's when Reed defended himself, pulled a knife, and killed him. And a kangaroo court was held, and many of them, including some who didn't like Reed, they found him too arrogant, and many were jealous of him because of his fine wagon that was unlike any others. It even had a cook stove and a feather bed in it for his infirm mother-in-law, who died early on, and that bed and cook stove ended up in the sands of Utah. But they wanted to hang him. And finally, cooler minds ruled, and he was banished from the camp and ultimately made his way into California, down the western slope, and was able, although he had a lot of trials and tribulations there, but ultimately was able to rally these parties and put everything together and rescue his family.
Just have a minute left. Just want to get your want to share this. This has struck me from the book, and then get your takeaway, the biggest takeaway from the story. I'm not sure how you pronounce her name, Aletha Donner.
Yes.
Year when the school would give the mandated unit on the daughter party, she would come sit in the back of the school and listen silently.
She would. She always appeared there, and she listened to make sure they told the story correct and true. That was her singular mission in life, to make sure the story was told. Other members, including some of her sisters, actually wrote books about it. And in some books, at least one, the cannibalism wasn't even mentioned. Much of the book is true and accurate, except the cannibalism isn't mentioned. But others talked about it and tried to overcome and contradict the scurrilous stories that were being told that are still told to this day.
Just the 30 seconds left. What's the top takeaway from this whole experience in writing the book?
The top take is what I usually find in all of these books I write, whether it's the biography of an old highway or an Indian chief or an oil baron or an outlaw or a party of Manifest Destiny foot soldiers, and that is... It always occurs to me how that again, another time-honored cliche, but such an important one, always rings true. Those of us who don't learn our history are doomed to repeat it. And I can see that now, even today, in this incredible political climate that we're now trying to survive, that many of us have forgotten the sins of our past when it comes to race and the fact that this land was settled by people like immigrant Irish and Mexicans and
we'll
Native
to,
Americans.
Have to leave it there. Out of time. The book is Best Land Under Heaven. Author is Mike Wallace. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and I'll be in Salt Lake this summer and look forward to being with you all.
Okay, thank you.